The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest-growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything, from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
And welcome to Breaking Banks, the first, the number one, and the best global fintech podcast and radio show. You can figure out pretty quickly this is not Brett King, but Ron Shevlin, Director of Research at Cornerstone Advisors, filling in for Brett today, who's managed to escape the storm and the cold weather in New York to be down in sunny Miami today at the Temenos Innovation Jam. Speaking of the Temenos Innovation Jam, the one in London is going to be held on March 22nd, and Dave Birch will be doing that as a friend of Breaking Banks. If you've never seen Dave present before, you should definitely get over there. He is definitely one of the top speakers in financial services today, one of the funniest guys and most informative. Also has a great podcast called Tomorrow's Transactions, which we always recommend here. Some other conferences coming up that you guys should check out as well in New York City on March 21st and 22nd, FinDevR. If you want to sign up for that, use the code BBanksDevR20 to get a 20% discount. Basically, that's the Finovate conference for developers. And speaking of Finovate itself, that'll be on April 26th and 27th in San Jose. And to get your discount for that, use the code BBanks20 for a 20% discount. Feel free to try BBanks40 and see if you get a 40% discount. I don't think it'll work, but hey, you might as well try it. And then also a little bit earlier than that, a couple weeks before in London, Innovate Finance is gearing up for their Global Summit 2017, and Brett will actually be there speaking as well. Last thing to keep in mind is that BAI is running their Innovation Global Awards again this year. Applications are due by the end of April, so you can find out about that, all that and other conferences on our conferences partner pages at www.breakingbanks.com, and they'll be listed here along with all the discount codes. Let's get to the news. I'm going to bring in Mark Hochstein and Penny Crossman from American Banker. Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So, Mark, I'll let you kind of go in first there and jump in first. What's hitting the top of your charts in terms of top news for the week?
Well, we had, as largely expected, an interest rate hike from the Federal Reserve. And this was something that the banking industry had been warmly anticipating. They've had extremely low interest rates for the better part of 7 or 8 years since the crisis. And you know, everyone who is even on a rudimentary basis familiar with banking knows about the 3-5-3 rule. You know, borrow at 3%, lend at 5%, be at the golf course by 3. I don't know how much hitting the golf course they're doing anymore, but you know, the net interest margin is sort of the traditional way that banks make their money. The difference between what they the rate on what they borrow and the rate on what they lend out, and margins have just been tight for a very long time. So this was definitely welcome news from the perspective of the bank industry. And the interesting question is going to be how much of that is going to get passed on to their depositors in the form of better rates for CDs and things like that, and how much is just how much are they going to try to capture? And I think it depends on the institution.
You know, Mark, you're nailing it in that this has been a long anticipated move for sure. For the past couple of years, the firm I've worked for has done an annual survey of bankers to gauge optimism. And finally, this year, they've been very optimistic that there have been interest rate hikes, which, of course, impact their positively impact their profitability. But on the other hand, there can be the potential downside of depressing demand for especially things like homes and mortgages and so forth. But what's your sense that there'd be a negative impact to this in terms of depressed demand?
Well, yeah, I mean, well, I think that in other environments that would be a concern. The sentiment that I am hearing in the last couple of weeks, when you talk to executives from community banks and regional banks, is that there's it's more optimistic than it's been in a while because of other factors, not just interest rates. There is regardless of what you think of the new administration, there is an economic optimism that is being felt. A lot of it's got to do, at least on the commercial side, commercial industrial clients are telling the banks that they're planning for growth in a way and for additional borrowing in a way that they haven't been in, 7 years. A lot of that is pegged to the prospects for corporate tax reform. And, you know, the bankers will be quick to add, you know, we'll see. We'll see if this administration actually follows through or is able to accomplish everything they say they're going to do. But yeah. It's definitely palpable.
Yeah, and I think in addition to the tax reform is the prospects of the regulatory reform as well. Yeah, we saw that as well in the survey. I've been calling that the Trump bump, the increase in optimism as a result of the administrative effects. I don't know if you had seen this, but Pulsenomics did a survey of, let's call them experts in the field, economists, investment strategists, housing analysts. And I found what I found interesting there was that of the 100 or so folks that they surveyed, about half of them said that rates would have to get to the 5.5-6% level before it would have any negative impact on either housing prices or depressing demand for the mortgages. So even with the rate hike, there still seems to be some consensus that the negative effect would any potential negative effect wouldn't be felt too soon.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. Just a much more, I think the general deregulatory bent of the new administration is, has just, really reignited confidence, in the business sector.
Penny, what's on your radar this week?
There's a lot going on. I happen to notice today, I don't think we've actually written about this yet, but, Delaware, is issuing a law that says they will recognize blockchain records. I think for those listeners who are blockchain devotees, you know, including Mark, I think it's kind of interesting. I'm assuming this is part of Delaware's overall plan to always attract businesses to their state. That businesses would be allowed to run some of their corporate stuff on, like, corporate accounting on a blockchain, including their corporate records and their stock ledger. So it'll be kind of interesting. Another really interesting thing, I think, is that the OCC finally issued a 22-page licensing manual for their fintech charter. Mark, you probably wanted to comment on that. You probably read the whole thing already.
I cannot tell a lie. I've not read the whole thing. I do think that what's interesting is the reaction that, and we talked about this on the show a couple weeks ago, the reaction that came out of New York from our neighbors, American Banker, is in the same office as the New York Department, or the same building as the New York Department of Financial Services. That agency was very quick to issue a statement yesterday that they're going to continue to fight this. I mean, they see a turf battle coming. The OCC is proposing a nationwide charter that these startups could avail themselves of, and you know, the states are saying, you know, we're regulating these firms, money transmitters, non-bank lenders just fine. It was very strongly worded. Maria Vullo, the successor to Ben Bosky as the superintendent of the Department of Financial Services said that they're going to defend the sovereignty of New York. You know, them's fighting words. So that's going to be a really interesting debate to watch. And the blockchain thing is interesting. You know, I don't know that, you know, I think there's still a lot of debate about non-Bitcoin use cases for the blockchain. So there's interesting arguments on both sides. The one thing I think though is really helpful about what they're doing in Delaware with putting securities on the blockchain is they're solving a problem, or they're attempting to solve a problem that a lot of people don't realize is a problem, or at least one of the things that they're trying to take care of is the issue of who really owns securities. And this is something that Overstock.com CEO Patrick Byrne has brought up a lot of times when he's talked about blockchain. And one of the things that it can make better is, you know, right now when you own a stock, you actually own a claim against your broker-dealer who owns it against a claim against another party broker-dealer, and so on and so on and so on until you get this the owner of record being this company called CD & Co., which is part of the DTC. And, you know, functionally, it hasn't been a problem. But in a crisis situation where some of those broker-dealers are failing, you know, and you have, in a rehypothecation type scenario where those, you know, the same stock may have been pledged to multiple parties, you know, you could have some real messes. You know, it's never, I don't know that it's come up much in the real world, but it's not a problem until it is. So one of the constructive things about blockchain is that they at least bring attention to those things. Even if it's not the right solution, they're asking the right questions, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, so while there's a transparency benefit here, Mark, is there an issue from a privacy perspective in terms of, if I don't want anybody to know what stocks I own, that's not something I'm going to be able to protect?
Yeah, you know, that's one of the big sticking points for financial institutions when they've been looking at blockchain is, you know, the original Bitcoin blockchain, even though all the addresses are pseudonymous, you know, you can see everything that's going on. And that was a necessary evil from the standpoint of the designers of Bitcoin, was that if you wanted to have a decentralized, censorship-resistant system, you had to have a ledger where everyone participating could trust what's going on. So if you translate that distributed ledger, transparency into a financial services environment, you know, that creates a problem. Now there are a lot of, there's a number of proposed solutions to that problem. Zcash, which is a cryptocurrency that is billed as being more private, more anonymous than Bitcoin. The same people who developed that are offering to banks this thing they call, Zlayer. I forget the brand of it, but they're basically using cryptography, new technologies like zero knowledge proofs to kind of bring confidentiality back on the blockchain so that you could have a blockchain that, unless you had the specific keys that would decrypt the specifics of a given transaction, all you would see is money moved from A to B on this date at time. So there's a whole bunch of sort of different privacy layer solutions now that are being discussed. So it may be a solvable problem, but you're right that it is a problem.
Yeah. And I bet you these are both topics that we're going to get a lot more into the news over the next couple of weeks. So look forward to hearing more from you guys about that over the next couple of weeks. But I'd like to ask you guys to stick around for the rest of the show and join in when you feel like it. Please jump in whenever you can. But let me bring in our first guest, Gaia Faso from Anthemis. Welcome, Gaia.
Hey, Ron. Thank you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. I know that a lot of folks who listen to Breaking Banks know of Anthemis. But for those that don't, can you tell us briefly what Anthemis does and then I'll and what your role there is?
Absolutely. Yeah, sure. So at Anthemis, we are a diversified financial services group and we operate purely in the digital financial services space. We invest in fintech startups or companies that operate at the edge of financial services and are looking at really disruptive technology solutions to some of the ills of the financial services world today. We also work with companies to help them in a more digital way. And we allow them to think in a more entrepreneurial way. And we also build companies, and we have a number of sort of venture partnerships with sort of leading financial services institutions across insurance and banking. And so the my role at Antemis is working in the advisory team, but also spearheading the Institute initiative, which is a specific platform that we decided to build and launch last year to help us reflect on some of the challenges of digital financial services today and some of the opportunities, very much with the recognition that technology has left society behind, and at the same time, technology bears some of the solutions to the ills that we've seen in the space of financial services. And so, yeah, in that context, we have a number of initiatives, including the fellowship, the other.
Yeah, which is exactly what I wanted to talk with you about today, was the fellowship. If I'm not mistaken, you're actually coming right off of the end of the past six-month fellowship program that ended in the end of February. So if you can, tell us a little bit about, if not by name, at least the types of people that were involved in the past fellowship and what types of projects they were working on, what kind of background did they have coming into the program, and what are they going to do now that the program has ended?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely, Ron. I think we are now 2 years and a half into the fellowship program, and I think we ourselves are still learning what's the best way to support an entrepreneur. We build companies, we are entrepreneurs ourselves, but obviously supporting an entrepreneur to the journey is a different thing. So the fellowship effectively is a 6 month journey from idea to venture brief, and we now had three batches coming in. The recent one has five really skilled individuals in them. And actually, some of the topics that we've been discussing in the first part are very much what some of these guys are exploring.
So what kind of projects are they working on?
We've spoken about the sort of distributed ledger in the wider world of blockchain. There's two projects in that space specifically this year. One is a peer-to-peer insurance network that is powered by the blockchain. And that's very much with the recognition that the interests of policyholders and underwriters are not aligned. There's a lack of trust in the system. And rightfully, as sort of Mark has just highlighted before, one of the things that blockchain helps us to do beyond thinking Bitcoin is actually to introduce a system that forces trust between unknown parties or otherwise unknown parties. So one of the guys is exploring how we can use the blockchain to, and specifically sort of the smart contracts applications, to create a cross-subsidization space between individuals where the underwriter is not required any longer, and sort of the peers fund the other peers' insurance needs through a process of smart contracts. In another application, we're looking at the use of cheaper transfers, especially for concerns humanitarian transfers, by deploying the Bitcoin, which has fractional transaction fees compared to sort of any overseas or global transaction system. But we're also looking way beyond, and that's very much in the spirit of the Institute, which is to reinvent financial services for the digital era and focusing on some of the human and sort of society impact of finance and digital. So, for example, one of our fellows is looking at reinventing the back office of the banks. And so we discussed how obviously we're now in more favorable interest rate environments, but still we don't know how much the banks capture that, simply because sometimes of the costs that these giants incur. And so there's one of the fellows that's very much looking at, can we reinvent completely the back office? Of course, there's a whole world of open finance and open banking and API banking that's enabling new disruptors to come into the system. But if you don't fix the core systems, core banking systems, nothing is really going to happen because the same transactions flow through the same old systems in the same very lengthy processes. So these are some of the thinking that we're doing, and sort of another another really, really young fellow who's in this year who comes from a background in sort of M&A, fixed income and transaction services as one of the big four, stepped into insurance from scratch and was very much looking at Anthemis to provide him with some understanding of the sector such that he could build with us and has built with us an insurance proposition that completely flips insurance on its head and rethinks the revenue model entirely. And he's now one of the top 10 insured tech disruptors by Disruption Hub, and he's been accepted in the London Startup Bootcamps insurance program. So some variety of proposals there, I think, Rob, coming from individuals who have background in entrepreneurship, but also coming from the industry and wanting to step into the shoes of an entrepreneur for the first time.
Yeah, it sounds very cool. I'd like to ask you a little bit more about how it works, because I can't imagine that somebody just kind of comes into the fellowship program and you say, okay, Ron, go take that desk at the back of the office and 6 months later come out with a solution to the back office problems. I mean, are you matching them? Are they coming in? Do they have to propose ideas that they're going to work on in the 6 months? Do they just apply with their set of skills and you match them to folks and firms, startups that you've invested in? What's the process by which you figure out who's going to work on what and how they get into the program?
Yeah, well, I, if it was that easy, we wouldn't be here. So, no, absolutely. It's a little bit more, resource intensive than that. So the individuals who apply, as I say, usually come with an idea about a venture that they want to build with us, working very much alongside our own venture building team. Or they come with us with a background in financial services and the recognition that the challenge that they want to solve for and need help finding what the solution for that challenge is. Or they come to us with a background in entrepreneurship outside of financial services and want to find out more about this sector and understand how their idea is a good idea or not. And if we buy into the idea and the individual, and individual very much looking at their capacity to deal with ambiguity, their desires for continuous learning, their curiosity, their resilience, then we would consider their pitch, which is made with a one-minute video that they submit online. We take them through an assessment center. We take them through interviews with the founders here of Anthemis, who all come from the industry and are entrepreneurs themselves. And if they make it successfully, then they're offered a seat on the program for 6 months. And during those 6 months, we follow our own venture building methodology, the same bread and butter that we do day in, day out in our foundry business and our venture partnerships businesses, to help them shape their idea into a venture, into a proposition with a business plan. And so we couple them with advisors from in-house. We couple them with coaches who all are entrepreneurs and come from the industry. Some of these guys have sort of set up teams for the financial services giants like Capital One. Others have led, started and led their own financial services companies by themselves, and they really understand not just what it takes to write a business plan, but actually really what it takes to not have a salary paid for you month in, month out, and just have to pursue your idea and find the right team that that can help you grow your idea into a business. We take them through a structured series of workshops that very much follows our venture building methodologies, which are delivered by a network of experts that come from Anthemis' wider client teams and networks, as well as our investor networks, as well as our entrepreneur networks and expert networks. And obviously, there's an element of peer coaching that we very much encourage in the group. And at the end of the program, well, they produced this venture brief, and some of these guys have been really successful in actually founding and building businesses with us. Like an entrepreneur who's been with us now for 1.5 years, Kyle Dupont, has actually founded Ohalo, which is a blockchain-driven data management solution for companies. And he's now sitting on, you know, in our office in Soho in London, working with the foundry team and growing the business together with us.
Very cool. How many people have actually been through the program already since you started?
Well, the program is more dated than I am here at Antimis, but we had five people in this year, and previously another 7 going through the program. And so now we're looking to scale from 5 a year to actually 10 a year. And we're very excited to do so. And we're starting to get some good applications for the new batch that's due to commence at the end of April.
Now, I know you guys changed the time frame. Oh, Penny, do you want to jump in? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, if you don't mind, I'm just going to throw a question in there.
So
it sounds like, you know, when you think about all of the accelerators and incubators and boot camps and whatnot that are out there, it sounds like what you guys are doing that's really different is you're catching people much earlier than the others. Like, they don't even, am I right in thinking they don't even have a company yet? They just have an idea, and you are working with them kind of one-on-one to help them develop that into an actual working company, so kind of catching them almost like seed venture rather than any other type of round. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, absolutely, Penny. That's exactly the case. I mean, and that's very much with the recognition that there's probably a gap in the market to facilitate talent to flow in financial services, and we're looking at talent wider than entrepreneurial talent, and recognize that sometimes actually the best entrepreneurs don't come with a startup, but they come with a fantastic idea and the right motivation. And so we want to take them from that stage to the stage where they can potentially approach an accelerator program or go straight into an investor committee. I mean, Antimis is an investor in Seedcamp. We very much work really closely with a number of accelerators here in London, including Startup Bootcamp and Rise and the Barclays Tech Stars. And so we very much recognize the need for that. And we understand that there's quite some support, at least in London, as one of the fintech hubs for that stage of an entrepreneur's journey. There's very little support to bring and keep talent within financial services, at least for what concerns entrepreneurial talent. And so we take them really early, and that's why we pair them with venture builders here at Antimis, as well as entrepreneurs as coaches, because we recognize that there's an element of learning how to build a business, and then there's an element of learning how to become an entrepreneur.
And is there anything different that you look at when you're looking at that actual group of people versus the more formed startups? You know, like when people look at startups, they think about the maturity of the team and the business plan and the backers and so forth. But if you just have one person, what do you look at to evaluate that individual and their ability to survive in this market?
Yeah, well, effectively, the skills for spotting the right founder of your investment are similar to the skills for spotting the next great talent that you want to back in financial services. So we invest in businesses day in, day out, and when we have to assess the talent as much as the idea. So the difference here is we don't take any equity in these businesses. We don't take any IP. The program is free, and we are looking for the track record that the individual has in having built something in the past, or in having enough expertise in financial services that affords us to trust that they get the space and we can work with them on the specific idea. Ultimately, it boils down to the idea. If we back the idea and the individual, then we will help them build that into a business.
So, Gaia, I know that the application deadline for the next session, which begins in April, is actually tomorrow at midnight. So if nobody else gets their application in and I can get mine in, will I be automatically accepted?
Well, I'm going to keep my eyes peeled for that, Ron.
Okay. Well, we are going to take a break. So, Gaia, thank you very much for joining us. If anybody's interested in the fellowship program, what's the website that they can go to check out the description and the application?
Yeah, it's antimisfellowship.org.
Very good. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a minute and have Nick White from Monetize join us and talk about innovation and innovation theater.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity. This podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Listening to Breaking Banks featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag Breaking Banks. Now, back to the program.
And welcome back to Breaking Banks. Ron Shevlin sitting in here for Brett King today. I want to bring in our next guest. It's Nick White, Senior Vice President for Monetize. Welcome to Breaking Banks, Nick.
Hi there, Ron. Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Absolutely. Great to be talking with you. I'm sure a lot of folks who are dialing in today are familiar with Monetize, but for those that aren't, tell us a little bit about what Monetize does.
So Monetize is a specialist in financial services technology. I guess you'd say our mission, our focus is to try and help accelerate the digital transformation of banks and financial institutions. Our latest product is something called FinKit, which I'm sure we'll touch on a bit later, but you probably know is best for the work we did on mobile banking starting in sort of 2003. So we've been around a long time. We've been running and are running services for banks around the world. And we've now taken that on to the next level in terms of our FinKit product.
And where are you based and what's your role at Monetize?
So I'm based in London. We have offices in Istanbul and San Francisco and a really sunny place in Wales called Cardiff, which some of your listeners might know. My role here is I'm responsible for a product and marketing, Monetize, specifically focusing on our new product, FinKit. So that's what I do.
Excellent. We'll get a lot into the details about FinKit itself, Nick. But you know, I know that at the high level, what you're really trying to help financial institutions with is around the topic of innovation. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is there is a term that's been thrown around a lot in the industry and actually across industries over the past couple of years called innovation theater. I think it's a really compelling and interesting term, but I think it gets misused a lot perhaps. When you think of innovation theater, what does that mean to you and where do you see it crop up in financial institutions?
So it is a term that we have used a lot recently, and for me, it really is the shorthand for a lot of the activity I see within banks, where they are trying to develop new ideas and new concepts, but they are really failing in the mission to get that stuff out of the labs and into customers' hands. So what you have is a lot of noise and a lot of theater around great ideas, some of them sci-fi, some of them more sensible. But actually, you don't see that stuff getting out the door and getting into customers' hands. So to be quite frank, it's nothing more than theater.
When you walk into a bank, what are the signs that you see that there's innovation theater going on?
I think there's a few telltale signs, I guess. And you don't necessarily have to walk into the bank to find out that innovation theater is happening. I guess the first telltale sign of innovation theater is actually just to look at what is actually left the door and got into customers' hands. So, you know, if you hear a lot of noise and you see a lot of PR and you see loads of great ideas, but actually when you look at what was released and made available to customers, then you can pretty much guarantee that if there's nothing getting into customers' hands, then there's a lot of theatre. The second thing, and probably the more visual thing, is you'll see a refit of an office, right? And you'll see you know, stale and grey offices suddenly turning into funkier refits, but you know, into labs and into new working spaces and places. But and you'll see the odd hackathon going on. That's all great, you know, really good stuff, lots of learning. But I keep coming back to the core point, which is if it doesn't actually have a material effect on getting stuff into customers' hands, then it's just theatre.
Yeah, I'll tell you what. One of the signs for me is, in addition to the things you mentioned, is a change in titles and roles. A couple of years ago, a woman, a contact of mine at one of the big banks here in the U.S., called me and said, I got a new position here at the bank. I'm the SVP of innovation. And I said, well, congratulations. That's great. How can I help you? She said, what do I do now? So it seems to me that, you know, they're creating these positions, and that's part of the theater, that they're, you know, creating these roles, trying to, you know, set the stage for innovation without actually having to actually written a script or even having anybody ad-lib an actual play or show. You know, another thing I wanted to ask you about, Nick, is another thing that I've seen in a lot of financial institutions, and I'm wondering if you see it as well, and if so, what you think they should do about it, is it seems to me a lot of the financial institutions that I've been working with seem very obsessed over innovation from the perspective of idea generation, coming up with the idea, and not enough time being spent on the testing of the idea, the scaling of the idea, or let alone the ongoing deployment and institutionalization, or call it productionalization of the idea. Do you see that as well? And do you think that there are ways that the financial institutions could be dealing with some of the problems of actual testing, deployment, scaling, and not just, you know, sitting around in a room and trying to dream up great ideas?
Yeah, this actually goes to the heart of the problem, and so I definitely do see that as well. And I guess just before I answer the question, one of the things I want to say is that those people that are sitting in the rooms coming up with the ideas are really often quite clever, bright people with all the best intentions. They've just been dealt a bad hand, and by that I mean is that they're working in an industry and an institution that has legacy systems and processes, which effectively just creates a dead end for them. So they can have a great idea, they can do the paper exercise, but they don't have a path to production. And so, yeah, the solution is to find a way to free themselves from those legacy systems and processes, and then allow them to test and iterate, and as you say, and learn and scale. And act, quite frankly, more like a, you know, a digital technology business, a cloud-native business, and less like a bank. And like I said, they've just been dealt a bad hand. I mean, I started my career in a bank, and almost the first thing I was told is that there are two releases a year. And so it's in their DNA then to try and stuff that release full with many different ideas, and often that then brings risk, and it brings jeopardy to the project, and it makes them very expensive, and it makes the cost of change very expensive, and there's loads of security and compliance issues, and it just becomes too hard. So we need to break that cycle, and we need to increase the pace of change. We need to reduce the cost of that change and allow these bright people to get their ideas out there quickly and to iterate and learn. And that's what was really the inspiration behind creating ThinkIt.
So how does that actually work in a real example? I'm not asking if you give any names of financial institutions if you can't mention them, but if you can, that would be great. How do they actually take it from idea through testing, scaling, deployment, and pilots to, you know, real results?
So in our view, the first thing is you've got to put the right platform and toolkit in place that's going to be the foundation of the ways of working and your technology. And that.
But what does that mean? What does that mean, foundation and framework? What's missing in many of these financial institutions that are is stopping them or preventing them from taking a great idea? Is it just, I mean, we talk about the legacy systems. Is there something you're bringing to the table that is different than you know what they've got today that is enabling them to take some idea and test it and scale it? I'm missing what the mechanism is by which they're actually doing something.
Okay, so there are three things that that we bring to the party to help that happen. The first is they need a developer toolkit, a modern developer toolkit that sets the framework and the standards within which they will build services, technically build services. And that toolkit needs to be something that you can spin up quickly, make available to their developers quickly, but provides a framework within which the concerns around security and compliance are dealt with upfront and taken away from the concerns of the developer, so those developers can get on and start building. So we do that by providing that platform and a toolkit that allows the developers to get on and start developing and abstract away concerns around PCI compliance and data privacy. We deal with that in the platform itself. So the developers can start moving at speed, working with the product owners to get coding, to get building stuff. But crucially, they need to be doing that on a platform that's not a sandbox, that's not some environment that's got a dead end. It needs to be a production platform, one that has the blessing up front of their governance, risk, and compliance colleagues. So we can break the silos of marketing coming up with the ideas and technology trying to build them and the risk and security guys adding in a final step of the process that often means that they fail to get live. So the toolkit itself is the foundation of our ability to allow the developers to get on and do their job and start building great digital services. And that's the first thing. The second thing is there are some components, microservices, that are going to be needed for almost any idea that you can come up with. And why would you want to build those things from the ground up every time you have an idea? So the second thing we've done is anticipate those microservices and core components, things like a secure card storage, things like tokenization, things like identity. These are very common components that are going to be needed for lots of different ideas that you may have. So those are pre-built components that sit in the toolkit. The third thing we've done is we've realized that you can't build everything yourself in order to put together a great end-user proposition. And so we've gone out and signed up fintech partners, some of them established, some of them new and emerging, and also put their services into the toolkit. So you have then an environment, a secure environment where a developer can build stuff. He's got access to pre-built components that can accelerate his ability to get a good idea out the door and access to components from third parties. You combine all those things together and you can start building products, digital products, and launching them because you're doing it on a platform that's already a production-grade platform.
So walk us through an example of a real institution and tell us exactly what was the idea that they took to the pilot, how what they learned through the pilot, and how they took that idea and went to market with it.
Okay, so for obvious reasons, I can't name names, but 3 weeks ago, we were given the challenge by one of our clients to look at how we could build an Alexa banking service. So the idea was simply that you can use Alexa to interact through voice to find out your account balance and find out your transaction history. Now, the first that seems like a fairly trivial ask. You know, it's two fairly straightforward services: balance inquiry and recent transactions. But if you're in a bank and you're trying to start that project, the first thing you're probably going to do is do that in some sandbox or some lab. With us, what we did is we started on the ThinkIt platform, which was already a production platform. So straight away, We upfront basically got the blessing of their security risk and compliance guys to say that the platform that we were building on, which is also the platform we're going to run on, meets their security risk and compliance requirements. So that concern is taken out of the way right at the beginning. We then start the process of developing the Alexa service. So there's the quick formation of a cross-functional team, and not just a team of product owners and developers, but a team that also includes those same security risk and compliance representatives. And we define the product such that we consider all of the main stakeholders, not just the customer, but the bank themselves. And we then worked with the client to spin up a developer environment. We did that in 10 minutes, a virtual developer environment. And that in of itself would normally take days, if not weeks, within a bank to get a new developer up and running using a system to start building something. And then we get into actually starting to write code with the customer to create the Alexa banking service. And what we've done is predefine what good looks like in terms of the service design framework and the API framework. So you take away a lot of the debate up front for the developer so they can get on and start writing code. There comes a point then where prior to the code being complete, we also mandate through the system that there is a checklist that we go through with the client to make sure that when the product is technically ready, we're also business ready. So that also ensures that with the client, all the documentation that's needed to support the operation of the service, the reporting on the service, the run book effectively for the service is all complete. And we can't push the development through the platform unless those artifacts are there and complete. And once we've developed the code, then we can push it through our pipeline, which is an automated process that takes that new product all the way through all of the environments automatically. And assuming all of the automated tests work, it will go through from test through to production in a matter of minutes. Obviously, if it fails the test, it will go back and there will be an automated notification back to the developer. And so we did this with our client. We took the brief of building the Alexa banking service, and we did it in 3.5 days, including integrating into their back end. Now, they themselves had done a POC of their own, and doing it in a lab, not on a production service and not ready to go to production, took them 3.5 weeks. So there are savings in terms of the cost of change, and there are savings in terms of the speed of change because of the way the toolkit helps you accelerate development.
So it almost seems to me, Nick, that for many of the financial institutions, especially large ones who've created these innovation groups, innovation teams, accelerators, innovation labs, almost sounds like they can be a hindrance to this whole process versus a help. Do you see that, or am I missing something?
I think that what's helpful is it's great for the idea generation, but what's unhelpful is... it's not, you know, the ideas are not getting into production, and we'd much prefer that they did that innovation on a platform that was production ready. To some extent, it is what we call it. It's theatre, and I guess what really matters is what you're putting in the customer's hands. Is it having an effect on their customer satisfaction? Is it driving new revenues? Those are the things I think that are keeping the CEO up at night. And yes, it's nice to have a press release from time to time about some great innovative idea, but much more powerful to have launched something.
Nick, how are your clients dealing with the issues of prioritization of a lot of these ideas and opportunities? You know, I think for a lot of institutions, despite the fact that everybody outside thinks that they're not particularly innovative or forward-thinking, my experience is there's a lot of smart people in these institutions with a lot of good ideas, that the problem is generally a lot more organizational and trying to get the management team to figure out which to fund first and how it's going to get done. How are you seeing your clients deal with the prioritization of these opportunities?
It's a really good question. And the truth is, and particularly in the UK at the moment, regulation and compliance with regulation is dominating a lot of the prioritization. There are certain competition and market authority mandates that have been made around opening up banking, which is consuming an awful lot of their time and resources. And so you can imagine the conversation that the CEO is having at an ExCo level where you're right, there are loads of bright people with loads of great ideas and loads of great intentions. But his CMO will be saying that he's struggling to get new product out the door and customer satisfaction is suffering. And the CMO will say, can you please talk to the CTO? The CTO will say, well, look, I want to help, but 80% of my resources are focused on being compliant with the latest regulatory mandate. And so you've got this sort of catch 22. So they have to find a way to break the cycle. And there are inefficiencies because of the silos. And there are inefficiencies because of the processes. And so the answer is to break that dependency on those legacy systems and processes and start innovating at speed outside of those constraints. And you will find the savings that allow you to do more.
Hey, Nick, this is Mark Hochstein from American Banker. I had a question that pertains to the security when you're doing this, because you mentioned several times, you know, this is not a sandbox. To my mind, the reason that you create the sandbox is that these banks put things in the sandbox is because if something goes wrong in the sandbox, it doesn't affect what's going on with the real customer. So what I hear you saying, and tell me if this is correct, is that you can have a platform that is ready for production, but it's still somehow ring-fenced or walled off from the bank itself.
Yes, so we call it our production sandbox. And in effect, our production sandbox is running on exactly the same platform as our operational service platform. And the reason we're confident about this is being able to run the production sandbox on in a production environment is because we built it from the ground up to deal with what we know, having run bank grade services for many years, we built it from the ground up to be capable of performing to the service level agreements that banks mandated. We built it to ensure that the data protection requirements were dealt with, and we built it to ensure that PCI was dealt with. So actually, yes, we can certainly allow the production sandbox to be used for building and experimentation and pilots, but the underlying platform is as robust as production, and we're very confident about that.
Nick, you mentioned that you are incorporating some fintech startups into the product as well. Who can you say who you've worked with, and more even more specifically, who's done a particularly good job of understanding and working with the larger FIs?
Yeah, so at the back end of last year, we announced our ThinkIt partnership program, and it's a broad range of partners from established financial service providers and technology providers through to the more emerging fintechs. So at the one end of the spectrum, we're delighted to have MasterCard as a partner. So you wouldn't ordinarily think of them as a fintech. But the great thing about MasterCard is they have some fantastic APIs that in of themselves perhaps are not an end-user proposition, but combined with other microservices could be something quite awesome. So we have MasterCard signed up.
They're such a small, piddly little company. Do you work with any big established partner? No, but just kidding. What about the fintech startups? But who are you seeing in that space as looking at incorporating into your platform and helping to bring to market? Because I think what they're really looking for is the help in scaling, and I think your platform probably offers them a lot of that opportunity. So I was wondering who the fintech startups were that you're incorporating.
Yep. So there are people like BehaviorSec. I don't know if you've heard of those guys. Great company. They do customer identification and verification through behavior. So for example, how you hold your phone, the pressure at which you type on the phone, the angle of the phone. So using kind of biometrics and behavior to help identify customers. We have a partner called Idealize, which is doing something really cool in location services and helping people think about location in terms of time instead of distance if you're trying to find an ATM or find a branch. We have Currency Cloud, foreign exchange service. We have LivePerson, which again is probably more on the larger scale, but interesting for us in terms of doing authenticated chat and customer support and customer engagement within a banking app. So what we've done though is we've been quite selective in the partners we've gone for to make sure that they are the sorts of partners that banks will be comfortable working with. That they solve a genuine customer problem, something that we see on a bank roadmap. And it's about sort of quality rather than quantity. Because what we're then doing is putting their capabilities into the Thinkit environment that makes them accessible and useful for developers to combine together. And I guess the other problem that we help solve is not just a technical one of partners and banks working together, but it is as much about the overhead of running and monitoring these services once they're live. So if you accept the premise that a great customer proposition is a combination of capabilities from multiple partners, then somebody has got to be looking at an aggregated view and monitoring and reporting on the performance of those services once they're live. And then you multiply that by many different types of products that banks might want to launch, and all of a sudden the banks are going to have a problem because they are not used to this API economy and managing APIs.
Well, Nick, we appreciate you taking all this time out today and sharing a lot of this with us. I'm afraid we're pretty much out of time, so I want to thank you and Gaia Faso from Anthemis for joining, and of course to Mark Hochstein and Penny Crossman for American Banker. I want to remind everybody that please go to iTunes, leave us a review, preferably a good review there, and subscribe wherever you can, Google Play, SoundCloud, iTunes, or go to our website for more about today's guests and the show Breaking Banks. And don't forget to check out the FinTech 5 podcast with Sam Wall. It just happens to be an interview with me today, so I mean, that's just pure coincidence. But thanks a lot for joining us today. And don't forget to come back next week. I think Brett will be back. Thanks a lot for joining Breaking Banks.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.